From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day despite the fact that great controversy persists in this country on the defining issue of race. What does it mean? Does it mean that the Republican Party is going to fail in its determined effort to try to win back control of the House of Representatives in an election that's coming up about a year and a half from now? But there are all kinds of steps on that election right now. Actually, there is a moderate commentator, somebody who supported Joe Biden fairly enthusiastically in the campaign, who says it's the Democratic Party, not the Republicans, that is on the point of dividing, and dividing perhaps even permanently. Why? On this issue of race. We will get to that. There are also issues of religion and religious divides. Religious voters, depending upon their denomination, see the political world dramatically differently. But I think most religious voters here in the good old USA could be against the idea of throwing someone into jail. Why? Because she has actually taken a photograph of a controversial passage from the New Testament and then posted it on the internet. And speaking of the internet, should the Republican Party move determinedly to break up the power of Facebook and of Google and of Twitter? President Trump thinks so. Do you? We will get to that issue. And also talk about the birth dearth, the collapse in the birth rate right here in the United States, and the ongoing fight for by Liz Cheney, who, according to brand new reports this morning, is not putting up much of a fight. She seems to have been ready to abandon her position as the third ranking Republican in the House of Representatives, at one point considered a future speaker or maybe a future presidential candidate. Why is she taking the position that she is not fighting back against determined efforts by her critics and opponents who failed last time? Last time they tried to get rid of Liz Cheney. She won by 2-1 in a vote by the Republican House caucus. This time, it looks like Elise Stefanik, who's only 36 years old, who is considered an up-and-comer in the House, and is by any standards vastly less conservative than Liz Cheney. Her voting record shows her to be a moderate, one of the most moderate members of the whole Republican caucus. She's about to be installed, apparently, they're talking about next Wednesday having a vote, as the head of the House Republican Conference. That's a role that Liz Cheney's father, Dick Cheney, at one time held. She is slammed today in a statement by President Trump, who is using his new web platform to sound off and to sound off against four prominent Republicans. We will get to that and to Caitlyn Jenner deriving all kinds of praise for an ad against Gavin Newsom. And it looks increasingly like they're going to be contending for the governorship in that recall election coming up in California. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. First, the issue of race continues to completely preoccupy this country. And there is a piece in the Wall Street Journal by Gerald Seib, who's talking about the way that it's become a different conversation. And he suggests that the differences in race are as much generational as they are racial. Here's what he has to say. He says, often it takes controversy and debate to reach a clarifying moment. And perhaps that's where America stands after a year of racial reckoning. By the way, I'm getting a little bit tired of this term, racial reckoning. It's one of those things you hear everywhere and people use it. What the heck does it mean? Because it sounds like it's a setup for reparations, which is not going to happen. And it is a terrible idea. It's even a terrible idea, frankly, to seriously debate. But Gerald Seib talks about the racial reckoning. He goes on, if the upshot of the current turn is an agreement that there has been more progress on race than some on the left will acknowledge, but also further to go than some on the right will admit, well, perhaps that will amount to progress. I think that's a great formulation, by the way, and I think that is where we are. We have made much more progress than people on the left will acknowledge. And yes, we still have a ways to go, as people say. But what does that mean? What does that mean exactly? And that's the real question facing this country on issues of race. Gerald Seib writes, the core of this conversation, of course, is whether America is at heart a racist nation or merely a nation where racism still exists. There are very few Americans, this is what Whit Ayers says. He's a longtime Republican pollster who's worked with black community, white community, every kind of ethnic and political community, though he identifies as a moderate Republican. He says there are very few Americans other than the ideological left who would disagree with almost anything in Tim Scott's speech. He goes on to say, Mr. Scott's formulation is a fundamental challenge to the premise of the far left in America. His overall argument would be supported by significant majorities of Americans of all races. Certainly the vast majority of whites would agree that America is not a racist country. It would be a closer call among blacks. What is it that Scott said that people would agree with, says Whit Ayers? What Scott said was, hear me clearly, America is not a racist country. It's backwards to fight discrimination with different discrimination. And it's wrong to try to use our painful past to dishonestly shut down debates in the present. And there's another pollster, John Zogby, liberal pollster. He says the country is deeply split on the issues of whether or not this is a racist country. And it is intensely partisan. He goes on to say, the divides here aren't solely partisan or ideological, though. They are also generational. And what does that mean? It means that people tend to be much more likely to believe America is a racist country if they are millennials than if they are baby boomers, say. Why would that be? Is that an indication that we haven't really made progress since the 1960s and 70s? Of course we have. I mean, black people have made unbelievable progress in this country. Why would millennials, who have grown up with a much higher rate of intermarriage, much higher rate of black success, and a leading numbers of black billionaires, a black president, black vice president, why would they be more likely to believe that America is a racist country than millennials? The Gerald Seib writes, an American in his or her 60s of any race came of age thinking the ideal for America was to build a colorblind society, and that the election of Barack Obama was a sign that maybe, just maybe, the country had moved into a post-racial period. But what Zogby says is that the millennials have a different racial composition. The oldest millennials are about 40% non-white, he points out. The youngest of Gen Z are majority non-white, says Zogby. They are together the most community conscious and active of any of the age cohorts. In other words, precisely because people of color are more numerous in that group, that group is far more likely to perceive America as a racist country. Is that based on their own experience when all indications show that the race differences or things that were blocked at one point to people of color are now wide open? We will get to that and to the Congress lady who says that every day we've seen this nation get more racist. Is that true? We'll be getting to it on The Medved Show. And on the Michael Medved Show, talking about the issue of race and the coming crack-up of a political party. No, not the Republicans. It's actually the Democrats this time. I mean, we've been hearing about the crack-up of the Republicans, and I wish they would do a better job of keeping things together in the House caucus, but we will get to that. I mentioned before a really stupid claim that I think we can respond to very directly by indicating that it's based on nothing. Representative Maxine Waters claimed people have been witnessing the country getting more racist with every passing day. She was on Sunday on a show in L.A. on KTLA called Inside California Politics, and she was asked to respond to Tim Scott's Republican rebuttal to President Biden, Joe Biden's address to Congress last week. In any event, here's what she said. As we watched the invasion of the Capitol on January 6th, those people, she said, following Trump, say they were taking back their government and they were willing to harm people. And then she added this. Not only were they willing to harm people, but Capitol Police, who happened to be the people of color, African American, they were calling them names of the N-word. Every day we have seen this nation get more racist than anybody thought perhaps it would be at this point in time. Okay, the example of America getting, I mean, even if she's going back, she says every day it's been getting more racist. Has it been getting more racist since January 6th? Where exactly is the evidence here? And this is completely non-productive for the country, for healing country, or as Brett Stevens points out, now he supported Biden, and he is not a fan of some of the directions of the Republican Party, but he just say the results of this kind of rhetoric will be a liberal crack-up similar to the one in the late 1960s that broke liberalism as America's dominant political force for a generation. He explains why in just a moment. Let me go to Braun in Snohomish, Washington. You're on the Medved Show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for taking my call.
My great pleasure.
The thought came to me is that we need to define what defines a country. Is a country defined by the rule of law, or is a country defined by the people within that country? Because there was a time when we were saying we were a racist country, which we were in the early 60s, before the rule of law was changed. But in my mind, a country is really defined by the rule of law and not the people within the country. And now we're pointing to individual people who are racist, and therefore we are now a racist country. And that's where I don't agree. So to change the racism that we're talking about now, we can't do that with a rule of law. It has to be from some other means. In my mind, it's through faith. How my heart has changed is through the pulpit, not through the laws.
Well, I think you make a very important distinction. The truth is you could define the country by its laws. The laws for 50 years now have made racism illegal. I mean, strictly illegal. You can face very big penalties. You can face penalties in the marketplace. You can face penalties in social life. You can face penalties even in your ability to communicate if you basically try to exalt and preach racism. It's not allowed in the United States, and fine, that's the rule of law. But I think people are also wrong, Braun, and the other point that you make. If you look at people, are there racist people in America? Sure. We talked yesterday about some of the Nazi activity recently in Edmonds and in Portland, Oregon. And, okay, but that is a tiny minority of Americans. The percentage of people who uphold and express and try to advance racist views, I think, is very small. and it's been greatly overstated. Appreciate your call and your perspective very much. Thank you. Bret Stephens, writing for the New York Times, talks about this crack-up of liberalism. And he writes this: it is possible to look at George Floyd's murder as the epitome of evil and not see a racist motive in every bad encounter between a white cop and a minority suspect, including the recent shootings of Adam Toledo in Chicago and Duante Wright in Minnesota. It's possible to think that the police make too many assumptions about black men, sometimes with tragic consequences, and still recognize that young black men do commit violent crimes at a terribly disproportionate rate. It's possible, he writes, to believe that effective policing requires that cops gain the trust of the communities they serve, while recognizing that those communities are ill-served when cops are afraid to do their jobs. The idea that white skin, writes Bret Stephens, automatically confers privilege in America is a strange concept to millions of working-class whites who have endured generations of poverty while missing out on the benefits of the past 50 years of affirmative action programs. Similarly, he writes, the idea that past discrimination or even present-day inequality justifies explicit racial preferences in government policy is an affront to liberal values and will become only more so as the practice becomes more common. In Oakland, it's California, of course, the mayor backed an initiative that was to provide $500 a month to low-income families, but not if they were white. Can you imagine? That would be illegal. How can you exclude a family if it's poor just because they're white? In Vermont, the state has given people of color priority for COVID vaccines. That's with a Republican governor. Ibram X. Kendi, the most important anti-racist thinker today, argues that the only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. So it's like George Wallace said, a segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Ibram Kendi says discrimination now, discrimination tomorrow, discrimination forever. It's the same thing. Some liberals will go along with this. Many others will find themselves drifting rightward, much as a past generation of disaffected liberals did. I think he's entirely correct. Now, what about that Republican crack up? Is that what we're seeing with the fight over Liz Cheney's future in the Republican Party? We'll get to that and more coming up on the MedVed Show.
You can really sway people, you know it.
I'm trying.
This is the Michael.
The greatest guy on this earth.
Michael Medved.
I listen to this show 4 hours a day. It's seriously the greatest show on earth.
Listen to the Michael Medved Show.
And if you've ever had to go to the doctor for anything serious, if you've ever had to go to a hospital for anything serious, you know that testing and analysis of what exactly you're suffering from can be a real pain. It can actually be incredibly expensive, risky, difficult. But what about a groundbreaking, non-invasive monitoring solution that analyzes subtle changes in a patient's speech to try to determine exactly what the patient may be going through? And by the way, to try to prevent congestive heart failure. Half die usually within 5 years of diagnosis. But carefully managing congestion fluid levels is vital to keeping the population out of hospitals. Well, there's this company called Cordio Medical. It's an Israeli startup, and they have figured out, and it's ingenious, a way to use your smartphone to analyze changes in a patient's speech, where they can analyze exactly what those changes mean to you in terms of your medical condition and things that can be adjusted before hospitalization is needed. Now, this is a world-changing technology. You can read all about it. Go to Our Crowd. Our Crowd allows crowdsource funding for you to invest in some of the most exciting technological startups, high-tech startups in the world. Go to Our Crowd at michaelmedved.com, and it costs you nothing. Find out exactly what is going on. I mentioned before Maxine Waters' statement that America is getting more and more racist every day. If you agree with that, by the way, you can give us a call, 1-800-955-1776, or if you disagree. Okay, Maxine Waters actually said precisely this. Listen.
Every day we have seen, you know, this nation get more racist than anybody thought perhaps would be at this point in time. We've been through the civil rights movement, where of course we made some progress, but this president that we had, Trump, was taking us backwards, and he was making racist comments. He was, identifying himself with people like the Ku Klux Klan and the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and the QAnon. I mean, that is racism defined in the most obvious way. And so to say that this is not a racist country, maybe he meant to say that there are many people who are not racist in this country. But yes, we have a problem with racism and that we must work to do something about it. Maybe that's what he meant to say. He didn't say it. And it's kind of unexpected that he would be so, adamant in the way that he said it. This is not a racist country.
Well, why not be adamant? Because, see, the whole argument of the other side is that America is so deeply racist that we need radical change to change the very nature of the country. And what's fascinating to me is the only evidence that Maxine Waters puts forward to America getting more and more racist is that Trump took us backward. Look, a president of the United States is very, very powerful. But the president of the United States cannot control the hearts of all Americans. Barack Obama couldn't change this country fundamentally. He inspired some people in this country. He horrified others. He was a president. History will judge him. And same thing with Trump. Did Trump change the very nature of Americans or interactions between blacks and whites? Look, a country where 15% of all marriages that take place are interracial marriages is almost definitionally not a racist country. Also, the approval of interracial marriage in this country is well over 90%. Regardless of whether it's a Hispanic, a white wedding, or a black Asian wedding, whatever, we're Americans. And that is what was so important about what Tim Scott said, is that contrary to the left, which wants to advance the arguments of that 1619 project to try to claim that, yes, America, from its very beginnings, it was founded on racism. You know, I've found a historical example where it's very clear that that is wrong. And this is very important. I'm probably going to post something in our history series, In the Light of History of podcasts, about this. But one of the things that is most important is to go back to the Constitutional Convention. And at the Constitutional Convention, the majority of people who were there to draft the Constitution were committed to eliminating the slave trade. Yeah, they were, including the father of the Constitution, James Madison, who actually was a slaveholder. but always recognized that slavery was wrong. And when I say he recognizes slavery was wrong, he said so. And said so forcefully and repeatedly. Listen, here is a clause in the Constitution. It's Article 1, Section 9, Clause 1. And when anything is Clause 1, that's something that is very important. And it's about the slave trade. We will get to that in just a moment. Let's go to Tina in Kent, Washington. Tina, you're on the Michael Medved Show.
Thank you. Mr. Medved, you and I can keep talking about America not being racist until we're blue in the face. But as long as there are people, idiots, like some that you hear, like Maxine Waters, in my opinion, is an idiot. The only people that I see and I hear continuing hitting on racism and racisms are black people. It's almost like they have a passion for continuing upholding this ridiculous notion that America is racist.
It's not just black people. It isn't. And it's not just people of color, so-called. And in fact, the overwhelming numbers of Asians and of Latinos don't favor reparations. There are lots of white people, including the President of the United States, who have recently been affirming the idea that America is systemically racist. This has become an article of faith for people like Elizabeth Warren, for Bernie Sanders, and as I mentioned, even for President Biden.
But it's not true. I don't know any other country that is more welcoming than the United States to any culture. Saying that America is racist, it's pollywog. It just isn't true. And, you know, we can keep saying it over and over and bring up a lot of valid reasons. But as somebody is intent into perpetrating this, that I consider a lie, to suit their own purposes. Because
Tina, I think you've hit it directly. It is to suit their own purposes. This is something my most recent column in Newsweek, which came out on Monday, was precisely about the desperation of the Democratic Party to try to build a whole, quote, non-white coalition around the idea of a racist country that all non-whites are supposedly victimized by. We will get to that and more coming up on The Medved Show.
Trash talker, that's what you are.
A trash talker.
This is the Michael Medved Show.
I want to get back to talking about the truth about the Constitution of the United States, the truth about the founding of the United States, the truth about this country not being based upon slavery, but being founded based upon a revulsion with slavery that most of our founders shared. Including the founders who were slave owners and wanted to make provisions when they got together and helped to draft the Constitution to make sure that slavery was ultimately extinguished, removed, destroyed, of course, as it deserved to be. What I was going to talk to you about, and there are two things that people always bring up trying to say the Constitution was racist. One of them is the two-fifths, the three-fifths clause, the idea that a black person who is enslaved for purposes of apportionment only counts as three-fifths of a person. And this is one of the most widely misunderstood aspects of the Constitution, or the history of the debate of the Constitution, ever and anywhere. And right now it's focused because there's a debate going on in Tennessee, as there is in a number of other states across the Union, about bills that would ban critical race theory from being taught in schools. And though I think it's problematic and difficult to start having legislation demanding what must be taught in schools or cannot be taught in schools, in something that is as wrong and misinformed as critical race theory, in other words, the idea that America wasn't really founded in 1776, the real America was founded in 1619 when the slaves first arrived, and it's all based on slavery. I do understand the desire to do something about that. And part of the debate got caught up in an incident in Tennessee where a Tennessee state representative named Justin Lafferty, who's a Republican, talked about the three-fifths compromise and was a little bit misleading in what he had to say. That's clip four, Jeremy.
The three-fifths compromise was a direct effort to ensure that southern states never got the population necessary to continue the practice of slavery everywhere else in the country. What does that mean? Appropriation based on population. That's how we pick. Everybody in here knows we've got nine state representatives. By limiting the number of population in the count, they specifically limited the number of representatives that would be available in the slaveholding states, and they did it for the purpose of ending slavery well before Abraham Lincoln, well before Civil War. Do we talk about that? I don't hear that anywhere in this conversation across the country. I don't know how we've gotten here. I don't know what we do about it. But talking about changing our history, changing's not the right word. Talking about incorporating another view of history while ignoring the very writings that we have access to is no way to go about it.
Okay, I sympathize with his sentiment, but he makes the same mistake that the New York Times makes, that CNN makes, that many in the mainstream media make. When they were debating what to do about slave populations in the southern states, in terms of counting them for apportionment purposes or taxation purposes, let me say it to you as clearly as I know how. Slaves nowhere had the right to vote. They nowhere had personal liberty. They, in many states, didn't even have the right to go to school or to have any kind of education. There were criminal laws that existed banning teaching black slaves anything. They were tremendously oppressed. They were treated like animals, basically. And the one debate that was going on at the Constitutional Convention was no one said, wait a minute, we ought to count black people as a full person for apportionment. The debate was really between counting them as zero. Elbridge Gerry, who later went on to become governor of Massachusetts and ended up being an opponent of the Constitution, when he spoke about this issue, how do we count slaves, and figuring out how many representatives a given state has in the House of Representatives, how we apportion things, he said, my southern colleagues say these persons, and they are people, are worth no more than dogs or cows. So why should we count them any more than we count their dogs, horses, or cows? And as he said that, not to say that black people were only the worth of animals, he said that to say how ridiculous it was to count them at all, that slavery was an evil institution. And that was the idea of the three-fifths compromise. They were about to walk out, the southern states, unless there was some counting of slave populations who never had the right to vote. By the way, already in northern states, there were voters who were black because freed Negroes in the North, they were not limited in every northern state from voting because of their color. And the attempt by CNN to try to fact check Justin Lafferty, well, gets to be a little bit laughable. This is CNN's Laura Jarrett. It's clip 10.
I can't believe this.
Yes, you can. And here's why. All these conversations are coming up right now as Republican lawmakers across the country are pushing new bills to limit what schools can teach students about racism in this country. But some now find themselves in need of a history lesson. Tennessee State Representative Justin Lafferty took to the House floor Tuesday, delivering an impassioned speech during a debate over legislation aimed at limiting funding to public and charter schools if they teach critical race theory, a practice that sees racism entrenched in laws and institutions, and one that has become a prime target for some conservatives lately. The Three-Fifths Compromise wasn't about ending slavery at all. It was one of a number of pro-slavery compromises baked into the Constitution during negotiations in 1787 about congressional apportionment and taxation. What Representative Lafferty failed to mention is that the compromise meant that a state could count three-fifths of its enslaved population toward its total population, even though enslaved people had no rights and certainly couldn't vote. That gave southern states more representation and effectively more political power.
Now, that's exactly right. That's why that compromise was evil. It was evil. But the right policy would not have been, because no one talked about it, saying, okay, you're a slave, you are dominated by your master. He can whip you and punish you at will. He can do anything to you. But we're going to count you as a full voter. And it's ridiculous. What the Three-Fifths Compromise meant, in effect, and the reason it was adopted very reluctantly with great opposition from, including from Southern opponents of slavery, like George Mason, part of the reason it was such a disaster and was evil is it helped to assure Southern control of the United States for the early parts of our history. There are reasons why five out of our first six presidents were from Virginia. And it's actually four out of our first five presidents were from Virginia. And then we had John Quincy Adams. But partially, you can look at those elections and see what the impact of this three-fifths compromise was. The impact was that Southern states always had more electoral votes than they should have been entitled to based upon the number of voters. And which is why you have problems with the Electoral College and everything else based upon counting slaves as three-fifths of a person rather than not counting them at all because they had no rights. And that was really the argument that was necessary here. Now, I mentioned another aspect of the Constitution that argues, I think, very persuasively in the other direction, which was the argument about the slave trade. They put into the Constitution a specific authorization after a period of 20 years for Congress to abolish the slave trade, even if the slave states wanted to keep it. And you know what? The very day that they had the ability to ban the slave trade, Congress did, and President Jefferson signed it. That was a step in the right direction, obviously.